the world's going to slow you down. Just expect it. Everything is going to feel like headwinds. Don't slow yourself down. So if something needs to be done, don't procrastinate. If that sense of accomplishment comes from you doing, and then, by the way, there's less of a compounding effect to everyone else being slow. But if you slow yourself down, the world will reciprocate in slowing you down even more.
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hi, leaders. Welcome back. This is Ledge. Today, my guest is Mirav Oren. Mirav, I would love if you would do a little bit of intro. I looked at your background, but I learned a long time ago that you know your story better than me. So I'm not just going to quote your LinkedIn. Tell it the way you want to tell it and introduce yourself for anybody that doesn't know you yet in the audience.
Thanks for having me. This is a pleasure. And yeah, and thanks for sparing me a mic drop. Sometimes I feel like I could leave by the time someone introduced me. Appreciate it. Hi, I'm Mirav Oren, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Versatile. And I normally introduce myself as a serial parent disappointer, as a second career. The reason for that goes through literally and very systematically disappointing my parents. My dad was a general contractor. He thought I should be a superintendent and move on and up in construction. I had other plans and I ended up at Intel. Too many degrees. And yeah, it's like that old company. The best business school you could ever hope for. And like some of my best mentors and friends and like what a wonderful time. But still disappointing for my dad. My mom, however, really liked that. She was extremely unhappy with my choice to bootstrap a startup and called me unemployed for the longest time because we did bootstrap, hence the serial parent disappointer. I don't think my background is that fascinating, but I will share why I started Versatile.
Yeah, please.
Just saying, it's a big part of who I am and the whole disappointing parent. So a couple of years ago, outside of being funny, my brother, aka the non-parent disappointer, he's a project manager in construction, and his project lost a worker that day. And not only was that devastating to him, it completely changed what I fondly call construction debate Friday night dinners. That was a very different dinner. And one conclusion came out of it, or at least one that's important for this discussion, and that is construction is truly very similar to manufacturing. And should be a controllable process. Despite the fragmentation, despite the fact that it's extremely non-structured and there's so many stakeholders, it can and should be controlled. The question in our mind at the time was, where the hell does the data come from? And can you actually create a tool that allows the empowerment of the people who build without the condescending tech approach that says we know better? Because you don't, by the way. Don't even try. Can we get data out of a job site, interpret it into useful, actionable, valuable insights, and put it back in the hands of the builders as power? And emphasis on the builders, you have to be boots on the ground to actually understand what to do with this. That was the whole kind of like premise. And we zoned in on a crane for honestly two reasons. A, we believe that it sees enough of those processes. Despite not all, obviously, it probably sees either directly through installing materials and elements and indirectly through just moving them. I think 70 to 80% of the processes we believe can be controlled. And it allows us the probably the biggest element or the one thing I contributed to that dinner discussion, which is whatever we do, keep it non-intrusive, naturally fit into the workflows, and don't ask the workers to record and report or do anything for you before you proved valuable at all. So that actually led us on an interesting journey of where we bootstrap a company that is a hardware-enabled SaaS, software as a service. And boy, that's crazy. The serial parent disappointer. My dad likes that. My mom, however, literally called me unemployed for the longest time and argued repeatedly that my kids will end up in a cardboard box. I guarantee you are not.
So, okay, you came from a construction family then. And so paint this picture. I mean, okay, you're saying cranes at construction sites. So I'm imagining big buildings. So what does this look like? I mean, hard hats and all kinds of stuff, like hundreds of people working on big commercial buildings?
Not necessarily limited to one type of construction, or we're really agnostic to most elements that you would imagine we might not be. We need the crane to be pivotal. So the way we collect data from the job sites actually goes through a hardware that is a hook under the hook. Literally just a lifting accessory. It just happens to be smarter than the average steel lifting accessories. It has everything that you could think of in a cell phone, plus a load cell that tells us the weight. And with all those sensors actually giving us data from the exact same point on a regular kind of like intervals, you'll be amazed at how much you can actually learn about what load the crane is actually picking, what process it's involved in, how long things really take. And I could never say enough about that. Like, the industry doesn't know how long things take it. And I have never seen anything improve without measuring. So you could think of Versatile as the first real measurement of like how long things take. And crane is such...
So it's not just an estimate.
It's always an estimate. I call it guesstimates, really. And some averages that you don't know where they came from. A lot of it is obviously dependent on what people believe things take, but not the hard truth. And with that, the crane is a barometer. It doesn't just tell you the story of the crane. It actually is the story of the job site. It's the pacemaker. And if you'd like, the job sites that we're a good fit for, that defines our focus and the job sites that we could be the most helpful for, and allows us to not try and sell outside of our comfort zone. Those jobs have to have a crane. It doesn't have to be a tower crane, by the way. It could be any type of crane because we're under the hook. But it has to have a crane, and the crane has to play a pivotal role. We won't take on a job where the crane isn't a pacemaker, where the crane isn't an unbelievable storyteller of the story that we want to tell. And the story we want to tell it to the people that we serve. We serve them with insights and with smart little, what we call widgets, that tell them at 5 a.m. what they need to know about yesterday so they can make better decisions, mostly like data-informed decisions today. From how you manage overtime, wow, to how you time your trucks, to how you actually manage your hook time, to why a certain installation, emphasis on measuring, normally takes you 8 minutes, but it took you 34 yesterday. And you could literally see why and be the judge. Now, if you're the superintendent, you got all the power. You are suddenly the most informed person in the room. You could have discussions that you could never have before. And you could swiftly make decisions that actually improve your outcomes. You save time, you save money, you avoid long conversations over who's to blame and just solve a problem. All of that enabled through what I would call automatically and almost magically shows up in form of measurements and insights that literally shed light on events that you couldn't see before. It's magic.
I've never had anything to do with a crane except just marvel that there's a lot of them. So how does that story come together? I mean, that seems like a very major insight. That point of reference can give you information that you can divine the story of the job site. Without getting too far in the weed, how does that work?
Yeah. Honestly, most people have never heard about it, and most people called me crazy when we started, hence the long bootstrap. We had to prove a couple of points before we could actually get the best employees, the best investors, the best customers. All of that obviously requires proof.
I mean, was this a theory, or like you really knew that was going to happen, or how sure were you? You're the founder.
Yeah, I'll credit that to being a founder and the blessing and the curse of being a founder, right? You have to believe. My honest opinion is, if you don't believe, no one else is going to believe you anyway, so don't even try. If you don't wholeheartedly believe that you can build it with or without the people whose help you believe you need, don't do it. You're not dependent on the different things to come together. You create your own reality if you'd like, and if you believe you're giving people the opportunity to join you on a journey that, again, adds value and makes a difference in the world and the construction industry. I grew up in the industry. I was on job sites at the age of 3. I've seen my dad go through really good years and really bad years. So I know the jigs. And if you really believe that you could do something that solves a problem and that empowers the people that you really wholeheartedly want to serve, then you bring other people along on a journey, not ask for favors. That's my approach to fundraising, for example. I'm giving investors the opportunity of a lifetime. I'm not asking for money. Like, you can join the journey and partner, or you could say, no, this will happen with or without you. That's what I mean when I say I don't need There's always a way. There is always a way to build something. You just need to believe that what you're building is worth building.
Your parents maybe trained you at dinner for investor meetings, because it sounds really the same way. I personally would like to be there at the table while you tell a bunch of investors that they're going to miss out. I think that if you could insert a sensor on that one, I think that would be a lot of fun.
There's a way and a method, if you'd like, to fundraising that probably can serve its own values. Thankfully, has done very well on the fundraising side. I'll say, despite the fact that it's in construction, which is not considered a sexy industry. When I first started fundraising, everyone called me crazy. Everyone said that hardware is a good reason to run away. Construction is antiquated and slow and just not a great investment. And I called them crazy and told them that it's the second largest industry in the world and it's underserved at levels that are literally ridiculous. And that if you build a product that actually serves the right people, it will spread like wildfire. It needs to work. That's a caveat, right? Like, you can't look. If it doesn't work, it's a different problem. But if you build a product, if you build a product, if the product works, if it serves the people it's meant to serve, and it's easy, and back to that non-intrusiveness that I mentioned earlier on, if it doesn't ask for anything, then you might just have a chance in this industry to grow like no one ever believed anything can grow. And with that, we proved more than a little bit. Versatile has raised over $109 million after bootstrapping, after being said more no's than most founders would probably dare to hear. But it's always been an opportunity. And by the way, at some point, there were definitely more yeses than no's.
Yeah, I guess so. You can't get to 109 million without some yeses. So now imagine then, like, when you're at maybe literally at the proverbial kitchen table and say, I'm going to leave. I don't know if it was right after Intel, but at any rate, you basically, you did your time in what I believe is one of the best run historical company. I've read the books myself. There's a lot to be learned from those folks. And then you just said, oh yeah, I'm going to bootstrap a hardware startup to help construction. I can imagine the stories around that. Mom's eyes got a little big and dad said, yeehaw. At the beginning, you got an idea, and hardware is much harder to bootstrap. So I'm interested in that story, because you do hear people still manage to bootstrap, certainly services, and then software is a little bit easier. Hardware, yeah, that pretty much sounds insane.
Okay. Yeah, I think bootstrap is hard. I also think bootstrap teaches you grit and forces you to check literally every morning whether you still believe in what you're doing, as you are at a constant risk of bankruptcy. You better be sure. I think it's wonderful.
I'm a bootstrapper too. Yeah. And I can literally tell you, to this day, we have a picture of a burning dumpster in our financial projections, because we used to have to go on a daily basis and reconcile cash flow and see how many days ahead we could push the dumpster fire. And we still have it in there, even in the years later being profitable, because it reminds us that you can run out of money. And the first time we ever pushed the dumpster fire off the number of months that were projected, it was like, woo, we made it.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm a wholehearted believer in bootstrapping. And by the way, the first money Versatile ever got was winning Mass Challenge, the accelerator. And I put that money towards, I guess, my first trip to my target market and filing a patent. There was no money going into my non-existent paycheck. I'm actually not the first employee of the company. I actually paid others before I paid myself. Hardware is hard for a reason, for sure. And by the way, the beauty of Versatile, it's really not a hardware company. It's hardware-enabled SaaS. And at the end of the day, our services, our software, our financial model is based on the software, not on the hardware. The hardware is an amazing enabler, and it gives you control over your data stream, which I can't say enough about the advantages of doing it. It's really hard, especially at the beginning. We built the first one. Like, this sounds almost like a classic like founder story, but this was a literal garage at my first CTO's house. And I think this story can be told now, but first pilot we did, we had three cranes, but the load cells that run, they're an important sensor. I can't say that we could really run anything without it today, but at the time we couldn't really buy, I was buying the load cells, and trust me, that was hard. I actually bought one load cell and we went live with one device that had a load cell and two devices that did not. And we still pulled it off and the data stream was incredible and we proved that the algorithm works and the rest is kind of history. But that's the kind of things that you do when you believe something would work as much as you do. And we very carefully what Crane actually does have the load cell and how well can we do with just the other sensors on the rest of it. It also served with good proof, by the way, of you can't actually do what we do without the load cell. That was good to prove.
How big is this thing?
It's big.
It's big. And so it hangs off the crane.
The beauty of the device is it looks tiny on the crane and gigantic on the ground. It doesn't, I've said it a million times, I think, it doesn't belong on the ground. It belongs in the air. And when it's in the ground, on the ground, it looks like it doesn't belong, which is probably true. I'm actually looking for a picture.
Just pick a common object for the audio listeners. It's like a hockey puck size thing that looks, maybe it's like as big as a truck tire then?
Yes. Plus the rigging accessories that go with it. Anyone can go on our website and see pictures of the device and the assembly and all of that. Our partners at the Crosby Group really power the entire load-bearing element. Silicon Valley company is not lifting 55 tons of materials in the air. That is done by the most incredible kind of lifting accessories that I could find. And we have an amazing partnership. The first partnership we actually struck with the Crosby Group for that reason.
Yeah, I can imagine that's not the type of thing, move fast and break stuff. No, it needs to be absolutely fail safe. And certainly there are companies that know how to do that. And so I guess you then figured out how to say, we need to turn that into data. And it has all kinds of other sensors then as well. But what I'm guessing is sounds like a data stream. I know I've talked to or interviewed folks that do things like they'll fly drones through construction sites and use vision technology and assess progress and such that way. But this is a very, very different approach.
Absolutely. And I love those other kind of like visual aids and progress tracking. This doesn't track progress. It tracks or measures process. And that's a huge difference. We can't actually measuring proc is great and it uses mainly kind of like visual aids and visual recognition. What we do doesn't depend on the camera, at least not on the camera alone, but literally on all the sensors, which makes it unique. But we could put a timestamp. We don't just tell you something was installed. We tell you how long it took to install it. We don't just tell you the material is there or not there. We actually tell you where it came from and how long it took to get it there. We tell you what took you so long to get stuff off your track. We know whether you took out steel or whether it was set up on the truck so you could lift and install. We understand stripping and installation on formwork. So that level of detail is process. It's not progress. It's really not about progress.
Yeah, I can understand why you describe it like manufacturing, because this is your line and you are essentially tracking every point in that, which then exposes you to all kinds of opportunities like Six Sigma and things of that nature. So you can say you can track variance and all the methods there to see if my end zone of what I thought I was. And if I'm not, then I know I can zoom in on that particular part of the process and see what actually happened.
The first step is identifying the load, identifying the process it's involved in, as in stripping versus installation, site organization versus actual installation. All of that really matters. Then the level of analysis, the sky's the limit on what you can do with the data. The hardcore kind of like base level is that ability to identify things to that level of granularity and put a second level stamp on it. So it's quite exciting to see what our customers can do with it. And I'll say it's not yet about AI being like predictive or prescriptive. That I would actually argue the industry isn't necessarily that ready for. I don't expect my users to believe Versatile's AI when it says this is why it happened and this is what you need to do. Guess what? There's so many other variables that we're not aware of, so much more context that the crane isn't going to give us that I wouldn't go there. I would give them the information. What I can say, however, is we know for a fact that this takes you 9 minutes. And we know for a fact that it took you 48 yesterday. That is fact. That is measurements. Hey, click on this and just turning their attention to a single process that took that much longer yesterday is the key to everything. Not trying to win the world and not trying to outsmart your customers in any way, your users, by the way. Like, they're there. They know. Sometimes it took that much longer for a really good reason, and there's nothing that they believe will, it won't repeat itself. And sometimes they learn that this, if they do nothing, will become the new trend. And then they're going to lose weeks on end on their schedule, on their float, and they wouldn't even know why. But that's the power.
Because it's like compounding problem, because you just keep doing the wrong thing over and over again. If
you don't even know when you started doing something that you didn't do before that is actually putting such a heavy strain. And it could be minutes, but they compound, especially if the process repeats itself thousands of times. Like, think about it. There's case studies on our website that Turner Construction, I believe, in the video that they published, they're an enterprise customer. They're an incredible, every team I just love working with. True for all our customers, but they published a video, and you should listen to what those superintendents say about just understanding that they should pre-rig, and that saves them, I don't remember, I think it was 90 seconds per lift times thousands of times, right? Take that and others where they have realized that they started a new practice that's actually slowing them down by 8 minutes per lift times 512, right? And they wouldn't even know. Wouldn't know until they have lost days on end. And even then, they might not know.
Because there wouldn't have been somebody, nobody was standing there with a stopwatch thinking about that. They just had a reason that they wanted to do a thing.
And even if there was a stopwatch, by the way, probably my biggest competitor, they wouldn't know what to do with the data. And there's no way that they would be able to float it.
What are you going to do with it?
So that's where Versatile comes in, right?
Very cool. And you knew you were going to get this data, but you had to do more than that. Was like, yes, it's a collection challenge. So now we know we can get data, but algorithmic design around that, because you were essentially dealing with data that was never available before, you had to teach that data to tell you a story, which is algorithms. Where did that come from?
God, no. So none of it is me personally anyways, right? I did not build the hardware either. Yeah. Just to be clear, you can't do anything without incredible people at your side.
You might have had crazy ideas of algorithms in your notebook. Now I want to know where it really came from.
My partner is like behind most of the initial algorithms, and then it grows. But like the realization that non-linear manufacturing processes can be controlled comes from my partner. The ability to actually teach the machine to use the sensors to understand the loads comes from taking like our crazy idea, if you'd like, into actually building something that works. I think that's the biggest challenge, right? You have something in your head, and then you need someone that actually has the right skill set to build it. And it's partnering with the right people. It's also knowing when those right people are no longer the right people. And the journey changes all the time, right? Just watch those curves. But it's about the right people putting the right piece of algorithm or code in place when that's needed. As I mentioned, it was built in the garage.
And I always like to know from founders, I know you had an idea. I know it ultimately worked, but how much were you wrong in the middle? And what roads did you just run down or too fast or speed bump here and like things I didn't expect? Like I'm coming off of, I don't know, 16 or 17 different startups. And just the most recent one, like all of our best analysis said we could do this thing. It'll go in this order. It'll take 4 months and it'll cost, I don't know, whatever, 40 grand. And invariably, then it's been a year and we've spent 150 grand. And now you just don't know all the things that are going to be hopelessly screwed up. And it's the little tiny things. I don't know if you had that experience, but you go, I cannot believe this one thing takes us 4 months to figure out and costs so much money. I don't know. Is that your...
Yeah. And without going into so many details, of course, we all have that, right? And sometimes it's the smallest things that would drive me completely nuts. And fixing something that, like, I think the team will say that I tend to say things are easy when in reality they're not, right? So in my head, it's all easy. That's just the way I'm wired. But then someone actually has to do the work, and it could be hours or days or weeks of debugging or coding or physically changing something in the hardware, which is even more challenging. I think the biggest thing is like when the hardware fails in the field, and that obviously happens because and you're not there, you're blind, right? You don't know what's going on. And that's when you become intrusive in a way, right? Like you actually need to ask your customer to reset the device, like literally do a restart. or you need to ask them to swap anything. Well, we solved it by making it easy, right? So battery swap is easy. The quote-unquote brain of the device is as swappable as the batteries themselves. So we don't need to go there. We don't need to interrupt their day. The crane is, it's a pacemaker. You can't just bring it down and work on the device. It's an easy swap. Right. Those things, sometimes like you just don't know why they didn't work. Other times you learn of a silly mistake of where you're presenting information in the wrong measurements. We have customers in Europe and customers in the US, and all it takes is for the measurement to be in kilos instead of pounds, but it still represents pounds and it's obviously the wrong weight. And those things happen. So it's this, but you have to be willing to take that with the rest of it. Earlier days, a ton of this, obviously. The later days, a ton of other things. It's definitely a journey. And I'll say, the one thing I'll say is you make mistakes all the time. You don't even know you're making them until you learn about it later. So I'm now paying for the mistakes I made a year ago. Last year, I paid for the mistakes I made 2 years ago. Lucky for me, I always said I'm making mistakes and I don't know. So I kept telling my investors, for example, hey, I'm definitely making mistakes right now. I just don't know what they are. But do the best you can. And again, believe that you're doing the kind of like the right thing with the information you have. And don't be afraid to move, even if you don't have all the information. You'll never have all the information, by the way. Chances of mistake are at least 50-50, if not more. And you might as well hope that you get more right than wrong, and that you are willing to admit when you were wrong. And by the way, fixing mistakes fast enough is possibly another.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, is the if you have fault tolerance built into a system you have allowed for already, that you can make a magnitude 2 error more often than a magnitude 3, 4, 5 error that really cost you. Like, and that's about cycle time. It's the same thing as like this mindset of the way you're talking about running the construction is exactly like what happens in, unfortunately, human processes where there is no sensor, but you go like, that's the job, I think, of the founder. I need to decrease the magnitude of my mistakes and increase the frequency of fixes, and try to just draw that curve out as you get more and more advanced into your company. Then you can afford to make more expensive errors as long as they're not all the time. But it still sucks when I just burned up $100,000 by making a dumb error. But when you're doing hundreds of millions, then you're okay. And it never stops there. You step up in these orders of magnitude of like, you can grow too fast and go broke with just a lot of money changing hands, just like you can in those original days where you only have $100 in the bank.
When it comes to money, I think it's a bootstrap mentality. You should keep it no matter how much money you have. We've always been very prudent, I'll say, when it comes to money. Obviously, it's easier to make more expensive mistakes when you have more money, and I wouldn't say we haven't. At least in the early days when the team was small and we were all in one room, like I could speak forever on growing a team at a 2, 3, 4x magnitude over a pandemic where everyone is at home and your entire team is dispersed, and how poorly that can impact your culture. I used to say those mistakes are counted as tuition, right? Because they all have a dollar price to it. If the tuition is well paid and it works you towards graduation, great. But if you just pay the tuition and you're going to repeat the class again, I don't know about that. To me, that's what you learn from the mistakes. And I used to say, just make sure the tuition is well paid, right? And that's pretty much it. It gets harder when you grow with remote teams. I can't say that the statement resonates as well now as it did in the early days, that I think people understood what I meant when I said, just make sure tuition counts. Stakes become bigger. There's more to lose when you do make mistakes. I understand the dynamics there. But in essence, if you still look at mistakes as tuition, it's a great way to look at it. One of my early mentors introduced me, I think it was Nelson Mandela, that says, I never lose, I either win or I learn. So I adopted that and gave it my own twist that said, tuition well paid. Just pay for it.
Wasn't there was a Jack Welch, why would I fire you? I just invested $1 million in your education. And I guess you start to think of it then as the average tuition for each employee, just like revenue per employee, because you go like, we need to spread this around now. So, yeah, absolutely.
It's harder.
What has changed for you along the way of team growth? You have to be the leader. You don't get to be the scrappy founder in the garage. You know, what what has changed? You have those principles, obviously, that have stayed with you, but there are changes. And I always wonder what founders might say to themselves, looking back 10 years, I wish I could send a fax to myself and write in big letters.
Oh my God, there's so many moments in the past that if I could go back to, I would give myself a different advice. Part of it goes to don't give up on an office. Like the whole virtual work thing isn't all it's cut out to be. I think that's the first advice I would give to my earlier self. It's not 10 years. I don't go in the past that much. I try to just look at what can you do about it right now. So if I realize I made a mistake, even if it's been going on for a very long time and I haven't seen it until and then eureka moment comes at like, yeah, and I realize that for a year I've been doing the wrong thing. Question is, am I brave enough to admit it and do something different this morning, right? And I think that's the hardest. It's not so much let's go in the past and give myself a different advice a year ago, but what am I doing right now? I try my best not to live in the past, but take the learning from it. So.
It sounds like you don't fall or train yourself never to fall for the sunk cost fallacy. No good money after bad seems to be the goal there.
Yes,
too.
I will admit that it's hard, and I bet you that I have made that mistake and tripped over my own words. And I'm sure the people to call me on it would be my own team, right? Sometimes you don't know or you don't see what you don't see. But I will say, generally speaking, yes, I think awareness is a big part of it. And when you're willing to at least look at yourself in the mirror, not at your past self, but at your today self, and say something has to change. I've made some really hard decisions. It's never all smooth and easy. We've made changes. We've let go of people because we decided a team is no longer serving the purpose. And I think that's always a really hard thing to do because I view people as an asset and I try my best to hire people that have a career trajectory and not a temporary position. If we hired you, there's a reason, right? So those are really hard. And you still need to, like, if you realize that you are going in the wrong direction, be brave enough to admit it, even if the consequences are grave and even if it's going to take a toll on everyone, right? But that's, I think that's what this journey holds. Like, it can't always be, yeah, we just raised a bunch of money and we're hiring. Sometimes it's the other way around. And by the way, be willing as a founder and definitely as a CEO, be willing to be the bad guy or the bad girl in this case, because you'll be held accountable. And it doesn't matter if you think that you've been wrong. It doesn't really matter. It's your responsibility. It's your accountability. Own it. Be willing to admit that it's on you. Even if you were in a different position, in a different seat, maybe it wouldn't be on you. But all of it at the end of the day, good or bad.
You started the story with your self-deprecation of serial parent disappointer or whatever you said there. And I wonder what dinner conversations are like after raising $109 million and building a very successful thing. You clearly have not disappointed. Does that self-deprecation in good form keep you grounded? Like, I do the same thing. Like, I'll often use that tool to make sure that I keep my own ego in check.
I would argue that founders need ego. I try to keep my ego in check. I'm also very well aware of the fact that without some ego, you can't really do what I do. Anyways, I have no problem admitting that I am confident and that I have ego and that I think that the things I do well, I do very well. And at the same time, admit that the things that I don't do well, I sometimes actually suck at. And that's okay. It's okay as long as you could, again, fix it or hire someone that's actually good at it. And also be willing to admit that the person you hired and you thought would do a better job than you doesn't. And then you need to change again. Again, it's a journey. It's a company. It's like a bean, really. It's its own personality in a way. But yeah, I think on the parent disappointing realms, I have to check. I think I did okay. My dad recently passed away and I had to do a little check on that one. So I think I did okay. I think I shared once that he visited literally during the 10 days, I think, that I closed our $80 million Series B. And I will forever regret that I couldn't really be there, right? Because balancing, but I think that was my checkpoint on like, are you actually proud now? Is this okay? But it was speaking of the journey and of balancing on the personal level, I constantly felt guilty. My dad was actually there. He was already sick. I knew that it might be the last time. It wasn't, but it very well may have been the last time I see him. Yet I was with lawyers and with investors and closing and debating over red lines on articles and making sure wires are actually done. And at the same time, he got to see this. It's not something most dads can say they got to see.
That is a tremendous story. Thank you so much for sharing that.
People need to know what it's really like, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think I talk to a lot of founders on this show, and I think I can often sense when founders talk the way you're talking, have a good mental health and self-awareness and personal care regime as well, because it comes along. And I suspect that you might have some advice on that as well. And maybe if you don't mind me asking that, because I sense that type of personal investment that is not just about work. So I'd love to know, maybe if we finish up with that, what can you offer there? Because you just simply can't develop that level of awareness without work. And that's not a job thing. That's not a career thing. That's a personal thing.
Sure, I agree. And I'll say that absolutely. And I could literally tell my good days or even my good weeks and months sometimes based on like how well and collected I am, right? I wish I could say I follow what I preach all the time, but I have learned the hard way that sleep is needed. So for the longest time, I've actually kept a regime of 3 hours like a night. Not recommended. Definitely not recommended. I would say much, much better, especially for interpersonal interactions when you actually give yourself the 6, if not the 7. So that'll be very high on my list. Working out, obviously, but just finding what grounds you. And I don't have a specific recommendation because I think it's very personal and every person finds their spiritual or their kind of like connection in different ways. To me, it's nature, for example. And for the longest time, especially during COVID, for example, we took to the mountains and we homeschooled and the kids spent most of their time in the mountains and I felt free. And like, there's a book to be written about how you raise a $20 million Series A while homeschooling, emphasis on home and not Zoom schooling, your kids. And they still end up ahead of the class when they go back to school a couple of months or a year later. So
my wife and I had 5 kids in the house trying to do homeschooling and running jobs. And I can tell you that I will never go back and do that again. I feel very confident.
I would actually do it again. I would give my partner most of the credit for where it ended up. But I'll say again, like to the self-care, it's those hikes were the best thing that I could ever do. I actually miss those because I don't get to do like mountaineering very often these days. So again, other alternative to just keep you outside, seeing some sunlight, time to think and time to reflect. Another practice that I would highly recommend, and every week where I miss it, I actually feel that it's missing in my life, is a gratitude moment. And it's actually on my calendar at the end of the week to just take a step and reflect and find something that you're really grateful for, preferably involving an employee that doesn't report to you, and actually write it down and sometimes even send a quick personal note to that person to tell them that you're grateful for them and for what they did. Again, I wish I could say I practice it every week, but in the weeks that I actually feel better. And it's a great way of grounding. And maybe the last thing is, and that's an advice I got probably from my first ever mentor, was the world's going to slow you down. Just expect it. Everything is going to feel like headwinds. Don't slow yourself down. So if something needs to be done, don't procrastinate. If that sense of accomplishment comes from you doing, and then, by the way, there's less of a compounding effect to everyone else being slow. But if you slow yourself down, the world will reciprocate in slowing you down even more. That little, I can do it tonight. And to me, it goes to understanding time zones, right? I could tell stories about how you close, again, massive rounds across Melbourne, New York, San Francisco, and Berlin all at the same time, with the lawyers wanting to go home at 6 p.m. California time on Friday and me telling them no, because like you're actually, by the time you come back on Monday morning, I have lost a day in Australia. I've lost a day in Berlin. I've lost a day pretty much anywhere else in the universe. You do everything Friday before you go out because they will get the day and actually get to do that. And I try to teach my team the same thing across different time zones. It's either a compounding delay or an unbelievable power where things just move from one time zone to another and work continues almost 24/7. So as a human being, I try to be almost time zone agnostic and always understand the impact of me shutting down right now. What impact would that have on other people? I'll say without expecting other people to do what I do, because some people will actually look at that and say, does she expect me to work at 2 a.m.? And the answer is no. But if I do choose to do something, for example, at 2 a.m., it's because I have those other time zones in mind and I make a conscious choice. But I'll say just that small understanding, especially for a founder, that you are responsible and you're setting the pace. It's true for almost everything that is positive and flowing and that allows things that are seemingly impossible to actually happen. But if you take a step back, the world will take a step back too.
Well, I couldn't have finished this up any better. It's fascinating stuff. Thank you, Mira. Thank you. You are an inspiring person. It's been a lot of fun. And before I let you run away, if anybody is resonating out there, wants to talk to you about your founder journey or construction or anything like that, what's the best way to
I'll say LinkedIn is probably the best way, but I'll say like reference the podcast so I know how and why you're reaching out. Our website, obviously, there's a Let's Talk that won't get personally to me, but it's I would normally get those messages. And yeah, but in most cases for personal, my LinkedIn is open. I could be slow, but if I see a founder in need, chances are I'll at least respond in a semi-helpful way if I can.
Again, thank you so much for the inspiring talk. Really glad to have you on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you for listening. And we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations, we handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.